Channel One over, and the beginning of the talk with Debbie this Wednesday afternoon, 6th September '72. She came back after she wrote a little bit and came back after lunch. I mean, for lunch, and this is it after lunch. This is continuation of this morning. The Debbie, this Wednesday afternoon, the 4th of September '72. This continuation of Debbie's talk after lunch, Wednesday afternoon, 4th of September '72.
But I'm hoping they can get ace out of them. Just pour them out. Just write one right after the other. I have no trouble getting an ace.
That surprised me. But I think it was by Suzanne to realize that she had never read through Moby Dick.
And this is her, supposedly her field. She's in graduate school.
Well, let me tell you, Debbie, I never either. You see, so much of it I'd come to, I'd skim it. I'd say, well, hey, another thing here. There's so much of it, you see.
It's a long book.
and one of the things that's so fascinating to me now, you see, the Pequod meets Rachel and all those things. Well, I just assume there wasn't a thing there. But one of the nicest is the Pequod meets not the Rachel, the Primrose.
The French
ship. The I can't carry it in my mind.
Kendall is the English and the Primrose and the
French captain had a surgeon. I can't reconstruct it right now. It's in my mind, really.
Dr. Bunker, yeah. That was the English ship.
Kendall. Yes. But the talk between the French surgeon and the captain is rich. It's just rich. But I wasn't looking for rich talk. I just looking for the damn plot, I guess.
And Gal would just use the first 100 pages most of the time.
None of the scholars ever say a word about it. They want Ahab.
And Suzanne would come in just one hour after the other, just in peals of laughter saying. And she saw all the fun of it.
Yeah.
She saw the light touch throughout the whole thing. You know, she was thinking she'd have to read the excerpts all, you know, all the time. She had just discovered. Why hadn't she known this before?
Yeah, Melville has somewhere along there that expression, tales of terror told with mirth. And almost all of Moby Dick, you see, is told with mirth. Even the first slaughtering of the whale, where it's so bloody, and the seal and the sharks, it's not in the telling. You see, Debbie's going to get all the reporting, you see, the tone of the reporting doesn't correspond at all to the tone of the experience. She's done so much, all these things mean something to her.
Nice to have the categories, I mean, be able to talk without
don't you know, like, they have a hijacking, and the little stewardess tells about it, and she breaks out into a big smile. She didn't smile during the hijacking, you see.
That's right. some awful thing that happened over there, and you would think it was a big joke almost.
Debbie never had the countryside. She can listen to them. She don't like the tapes, but she can listen to them. She can go out and hear some of the people. And you'll never recover from it. Maybe you shouldn't. Just listen to me. You recover from that.
How was it? Suzanne wrote this paper on Miss Marion. A professor said.
Oh, Faye, you're getting too hot, huh?
Okay. Anyway. Something.
I tell you what, I'd be strongly tempted to just knock off and go right down to Mississippi. That just fascinates me. It's not because Faulkner, it's his world, but it's. And it seems to be vigorous, you see. A lot of the old sayings are. On the seed, and they're not interesting. McIntyre's really not interesting. I see it. It's called seed. So it's making money. But now that Russell's world, your roommate's world down in Mississippi, it seems to have some bigger left.
Plenty of it with lots of teeth.
Now, you don't get anything like that in Florida. You see, Florida has been a frontier at all, and it's hard bitten down here. You don't see that side of it. I have seen it, felt it. You don't get anything like that.
It's frontier.
It's rough. Has been. I think it still is. Even university, I think, is.
I mean, there are no sort of genteel old families in Florida, like in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, and nothing like that here. But that's what's rough.
Well, don't press me because I don't know. But I haven't run into any of it.
In general.
You see, I don't know. I just don't know. And now you see, I really don't have the contacts. You see, you were building up things that I knew that I don't know. You see, and making me more formidable, and I'm not actually formidable. And your contacts are much broader than mine. You have access to so many more people than I have access to. I'm sort of cut off. Now, I've seen certain things that you haven't seen, but I have worked hard for it. It hadn't come easy. And I just would actually love to get out. I would. So many things seem to hold me down, you see. Keep me stuck. And I was never stuck till I got to Florida. Actually, never stuck till I got down here, and actually not stuck until.
Got to the table.
Yes.
To this patch, Ratner.
And I do. Yes. I just love to be on the road for a while. Not alone, you see. I'd like to have you and Rick along with me. I mean, you see, they don't want to accept me now. I have to face that. I'll accept you. You can go anyway. And we can. Well, I'll sit in the car and you can come tell me about it.
We'll let you out of the car.
That's I'd love to share.
country, you grew up chattering. You know, you don't grow up and say Miles is the name, get introduced. And he always sort of honk your horn and go up chattering, you know, like you heard him say the other day. And first time guy got Rick for that, Rick was trying to do like the countryside. I remember Rick came out here, he got out of his car, and he said to the guy, well, how are you this morning?
How do you feel this morning?
He was trying.
Did you write to me?
Trying to shadow it. He is so funny. He really just try to learn. It's cute. And trying to look rough. He's got that clean car. He can't make it rough.
Yeah. Dave, let me tell you, I've got to go work, and you've got to do something too. Let me tell me something else before you go. Russell has had enough of that Mississippi stuff for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And since she left Duke, she's been in New York, and part of the time just organizing, how'd you say it?
Strikes. Tenant strikes.
Yeah. Protest against the high rents.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's in her on the side.
That's on the side. She works in a publishing house.
But she could do that after hours. But she was scared on that steamer going to Corsica.
Did I say?
I wasn't.
Yeah. That's something, isn't it? Is she like her grandmother? Is she always getting into something interesting?
Well, she gets involved with a lot of interesting people because of this organizing. She gets to know all the people in the building and find out what they're all doing there. Like Johnny and Susie upstairs are Eurasian hat dancers, and somebody downstairs does something else interesting, like somebody's a painter and somebody else is something else, and everybody in the building has got do interesting things, you know, but none of them are doing it as their job. They're all supporting themselves different ways. The hat dancers are the only people that make a living at it. Russ can't make a living organizing buildings. She's got to work in a publishing house, publish paperback books.
Yeah.
But she lives a real New York existence now. She lives in one room, and it's got two windows, three windows, and two of the windows have bars on them because her apartment opens onto the fire escape, and you can't live in New York and have a fire escape outside an open window. So she's got bars on the two windows in the big room, and then she's got a kitchen and a bathroom that's sort of they're so narrow that you walk into them and you touch the other wall like and it's just a partition that's gone down the third window so that there's half a window in the bathroom and half a window in the kitchen. Just two little closets like that and a room. And a lot of plans. Everybody in New York always has a lot of plans. Pretend that they're bringing the Central Park into their apartment.
she had room for you?
Yeah, she has a hammock. When she puts the hammock up, it goes from one corner of the room to the other. And then she has a couch where people can sleep if they come to visit her. She sleeps in the hammock all the time. She never sleeps in a bed.
Maybe.
You ever slept all night in a hammock?
No.
I haven't either. She wouldn't let me. She won't give it up. She just sort of rolls up in the hammock like a cocoon and swings all night in the hammock. And they have to have special people to come and hang the hammock because you can't just hang a hammock from any stud in the wall. You have to get the biggest stud. And so they send around hammock hangers to hang the hammock when you buy the hammock, you register your name and your address, and then when you move, you call them up and they come and reestablish your hammock. Rehang it. So she's got this hook about this big that's hanging out of one wall and out of the other wall, and the man that hung it for her sort of mutilated the plaster around it so that there's just this big hook with coming out of a jagged hole in the plaster. And the hammock. But she takes the hammock down in the daytime. All you have is the remains, the hooks.
She's really seen the world, hasn't she? I never saw anything like that.
30 minutes in a hammock that I've known, it breaks my back.
I can't imagine sleeping in one all night.
Did you see her sleeping in it?
Sure. I visited her a lot, and she always sleeps in the hammock.
And it didn't hurt her?
No, she's perfectly healthy. She's been sleeping in a hammock for 2 years now. She never sleeps in a bed. The only thing is that I think it's made her a very active. She rolls around a lot when she sleeps because we had to share a bed in France for about 2 weeks because you couldn't get two beds in the hotels. So we'd have these great big old beds that were all full of lumps and holes. You sort of gravitate to the middle. Well, Russ sleeps like this, and I'd have to wake up.
Flings her arms.
She flings her arms, and then she rolls around a lot, and I think it's because she's used to sleeping in a hammock. So I'd have to wake her up in the middle of the night several times every night. Move over, you're on my half of the bed. The first night we did it, she said, "Now, Debbie, if I hit you in the night, wake me up." So I did. And she got mad.
What'd she do?
She said, "Why are you waking me up?" And I said, "Because you're on my half of the bed. Get over." So she moved.
Oh, you mean when she woke up, she was put out with it?
And she told me to wake her up. Oh, dear.
Well, maybe they should go to New York for a while, and then she'll appreciate Mississippi. Do you suppose?
I hope she does sometime. She needs to.
Mississippi needs her.
Mississippi, oh, Mississippi'd never recover if she went back. She's taken apart by the seams. Quite something.
And they knock around together, see?
Yeah.
Where else you go together?
Well, we've been all over New York and Boston together a lot. We used to see each other every couple months. She'd usually come up to Boston to get out of New York. Now, this is the girl who says that she loves New York and would never live anywhere else, but she always wanted to get out of it and come to Boston to see me because it was there were trees on our street. She used to come up to see me in Boston all the time. I went down to see her a couple of times in New York, but just twice, really, in 3 years. I went to see her. She usually came up to see me.
And you went to Corsica?
And then she wanted to come over to France and meet me, so she did. So we spent 3 weeks together in France.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that cut out on your French.
I just spoke English to her. I spoke French when I wasn't speaking to her.
Yes.
I spoke Southern when I spoke to her.
Yeah. Well, you were 3 weeks in Corsica.
No, then after Corsica we went to Marseille, and right around Marseille, and then we went to Nevers, and then we went to Paris. We were in Paris for about 10 days, a week, I guess. I was there 10 days, Russ left.
You hadn't spoken of that. We didn't know you went to Paris.
Oh yeah, I went to Paris for a week. We lived in a flea bag hotel. Next to the station, because we didn't think we'd find a hotel, so we took the first one that had a vacancy because the first couple of ones were full. We called some, and then we went around to some, and they were all full. So we took this hotel, and it was really something else. It was $2 a night, which is about as cheap as you can get in Paris now. And it was, I think it was for people who were coming in on the train and they had to spend the night and leave the next day. That, you know, that's all. But there wasn't a bathroom in the whole hotel. We decided after about 4 days that we really would like to take a bath, and we were trying to figure out how we could do it, whether we would go to a public bathhouse or if we knew anybody in Paris that had a bathroom, whether we could smuggle ourselves into the university. Because it was summertime, and it was a dirty city, and we were just getting sort of sooty, you know, and we had a sink about this big to wash in, which is all right for a while, but you just don't want to do it for forever and ever. Yeah. We just wanted one bath, that's all. So we switched hotels finally, and our only criterion was that there be a bathroom in the hotel.
Not necessarily private.
No, that didn't matter, just so long as there was one in the building. I mean, no, we didn't care a bit if it was down the hall. That didn't matter at all, but there wasn't one in the building. It was just rooms to, you know, for the night, I guess. People rented them. And we walked in to rent the room, and I knew we were going to be there a week, and so I told the woman, I said, "Well, we'd like the room for a week." And she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, "Oh, well, so much the better. Come here." And she must have thought we were awful fools.
She didn't know what was on your mind.
She just couldn't understand why these two girls were walking into her hotel and wanted to stay a week. I don't think she'd had anybody stay a week in her hotel. Should have told her we were from Guy Michelin or something like that. They're going to raid her hotel. The Guy Michelin. That's the French guide that rates all the hotels and gives
Michelin,
them
yeah.
stars and everything.
Yeah.
And that people have been known to commit suicide because their rating is dropped in the Guy Michelin.
Yeah, we had one.
There were headlines this year because Maxim's in Paris dropped one of its stars, and everybody, all the critics were writing long editorials because it was the end of an era. There were better restaurants than Maxim's in France, I guess.
I swear, they really cut out, didn't they? Well, Debbie, why did you write such prissy little letters?
And all that cutting up you're doing?
Sounds as if you had a bow in your hair.
Oh, I didn't know it sounded like that.
That is.
Well, that's nice. But you know, the thing, Paris is expensive if you go in the tourist sections.
It is.
But you can go in the French sections and live at a moderate expense. It's higher than Germany. I think it has a reputation of being higher than England or any other European section.
Mm-hmm.
But even so,
mm-hmm.
Eat well.
Mm-hmm.
If you know kind of how, isn't it? How'd you eat?
Oh, we ate. Well, we ate out in restaurants at night. We usually didn't eat lunch at all unless we just took bread and cheese or something like that. But prices are so much cheaper there. Boy, you get a whole meal for what you pay for a hamburger here, practically. I mean, it's expensive in Paris, but it's nothing like here. I was so shocked the first time I went into a restaurant in this country and saw $3.75 for a chopped sirloin steak. It's ridiculous. But
yes,
we.
I give you apoplexy.
And New York is
awful. Well, Boston's awful too. It's just hideously expensive. But we just sort of went into. Well, we were staying over on the West Bank, and we'd had some friends in Nice that I'd asked for restaurants and things like that, and they just told us the name of a street that where they like to go, and we just sort of walked up and down the street and ate in any restaurants that looked good, and down the street read the menu and go in. They were usually busy, depending on that. Well, peak time was about 8:30, I guess, at night. Could go before that, it would be a little less crowded, or if you went after, it would be a little less crowded. We went to one place. We went back several times. It was because the menu changed every night. They just they didn't have a set menu. It would everything on the menu would change instead of just the set. In some restaurants, they'd have the same thing on the menu all the time, but then they'd pick out things to make the fixed menu. But this place, everything on the menu changed every night. And if you went too late, you wouldn't get anything. You'd go down the list and they'd say, well, no, we're out of that, we're out of that, we're out of that, we're out of that. You wouldn't get too much. You wouldn't get what you wanted. It would always be good, but you just wouldn't get what you wanted.
So well, you know, really. Russ left you then in Paris.
She left me in Paris.
And then you were all by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In Paris?
Mm-hmm. I went to Saint-Denis when I was by myself. I went out to Saint-Denis to see the... That was the beginning of my Gothic grope. I wanted to see Saint-Denis because it was the first, sort of the first Gothic cathedral. So I took me all day to get out there because I had to take one subway to the end of the line. And I had to take a bus out to Saint-Denis. And then the bus driver, I talked to the bus driver when I got on and I said, I want to go see the Basilica. Would you let me off when we get there? You know, I don't know where I'm going. And could you tell me? Oh, yes, I'll tell you. Well, he forgot. He forgot to tell me. And I saw the spires of the church as we were going along and I thought, there's the church. That's where I want to get off. But we weren't in front of it or next to it. And we were several streets over. And so I thought, well, maybe we're going to go up and turn around and come back in front of it. So I didn't say anything to him, and then suddenly there we were in the terminal with all these other buses parked. So I went up to him and I was the only person on the bus, and I said, did you forget to let me off? He said, oh yes, oh mon dieu, I forgot to let you off. And he got terribly exercised about it, and he said, just come and get on this next bus and then they'll take you back to the cathedral. And now he said, he told me to wait on the bus and he'd take me back. And so I went and sat down again. And then he went running off, and he talked to the man in the bus ahead of him and came running back, and he said, you get off and go get on this bus because he's going to leave before I'm going to leave, and he'll let you off where you're supposed to get off. And so I got on the next bus, and they took me right up to the front door practically.
Well,
so yeah,
that's just fabulous, isn't it? Just
see, that is what happens to us.
Everything happens. Yeah. He wouldn't leave you loose end.
No. Everybody was so amazed because I was a girl and I was traveling alone. That I was by myself. They didn't understand that. I used to talk to people on the trains. I talked to this one old couple who were they had been on vacation and they were going home. They were from Normandy. They had been down in on the west coast, on a sea resort, and they were going back home to their village in Normandy. And all they could talk about was the fact that I was a girl alone, and I'd try to get them to say something else, and the little wife would just keep saying, "Isn't your mother worried about you? Does your mother know where you are?" And when I said no. she couldn't cope with it. She said, "Aren't you afraid?" And I said, "No, I keep meeting nice people like you."
Yeah. Deborah, tell me one thing. When I miss Cuba. I thought you were on your way home, and I just kidding you. About this little freshman, you know, that had written those things. And I thought you'd be home in a week or two. I had understood you were coming back early in June, but it didn't matter. Anyhow, I miss Cuban. And you seemingly, that wasn't exactly. I had misgivings about it. But it was a curious little thing. It never would happen again. He was one proselyte I made in a whole freshman class, and it was a pretty good class. He was the only one who had the nerve to come along with me. And he wrote with me all term. Sat in there was upperclassmen. That takes nerve for a freshman.
Yeah, in the 400 class.
Yeah. And I tell you what he did. You see, all the young now are self-possessed. And they don't let many in here now who aren't pretty literate. And he could type just like you do. Not as well, but he could, you know, do that. And he was the foremost one in that group. And what he did, just purely accidental, he went over to Dodge on Saturdays. He went three or four Saturdays in a row. They got a lot of children. Mr. Dodd was building a fence. And all he did was follow Mr. Dodd and say what he did, and the children and Ms. Dodd. And it's just chronicle-like, just circumstantial. But his view of Mr. Dodd, it looks as if he's standing there with his mouth open. Mr. Dodd is just an ordinary fella, but he turns out to be a sort of a genius. And he operates that tractor as if he's a trapeze artist. And the boy just couldn't believe it. And he was just under a spell. I had given him a little help, you see. I had an hour tape that I made of Mr. Dodd over here one time when his wife and family had gone down to Central Florida, their home, to get out of the Hawthorne trouble over integration for school. It was very bad. In stay, they were gone for a while, long enough for me to get Mr. Dodd over here a time or two. And he talked about the monkey. They have pets. Sit down, Faye, and quit monkeying around. You're worth monkeys. And to hear Mr. Dodd relate that monkey would just silence you for the rest of your life. You just say, it's pretty tame stuff. The way he talks. And he don't know it. He doesn't know how gifted he is. And that's the trouble with the countryside. When it comes to talk, you see, they don't know how gifted their talk is. And, you see, now, the boy didn't hear too much talk. See, I'm the one that gets the talk. The young don't get it that much. But he saw things I would never see. He saw it by them. And he'd come right back over here, you see, and spend the night. Just work all through, all hours, just getting it down. He didn't shape it up, you see. He just set it down. It wasn't so much him as Mr. Dodd. And he was faithful to Mr. Dodd. And he'd go back whenever he could. And every time Mr. Dodd would be on that tractor or something, and he'd have another adventure. Why, it's almost a masterpiece. I've never showed it to anyone, you see. The things that you all do out here, private. And I sent a copy to Faye, little Faye. Just the Xerox copy, that's all.
But it was to have Alan see this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I might have been over there and been in the same position. That done exactly what he did and wouldn't
see it. Yeah,
wouldn't
see it.
Mm-hmm.
But Alan could see it.
And it was so clear the way he said it. Faye wrote back and said she wished she could write like that.
Yeah. Well, it's nothing.
It seems so simple.
Now, where did I take off from? What were you doing?
She hadn't heard the countryside.
No. There's something she was doing. He was talking to this timid couple from the West Coast. What's the connection?
on the train.
Yeah.
Talking to them on the train. And they weren't, didn't understand why I was riding around by myself on French trains.
Oh, that was in France.
Mm-hmm.
Already in France.
When I went to Germany, I could hardly ride the trains because I couldn't speak the language. Couldn't get out of the station. I didn't know what exit was. Oh, dear. It really makes a difference. You can read Ausgang. That's where I met the woman who spoke French and stayed with her the whole time, and she got me on all the wrong trains. She had me change trains about 4 times, and I was only supposed to, I was supposed to have been on a direct train from Strasbourg to Darmstadt. And I changed, I didn't change 4 times, I changed twice instead. And I wasn't supposed to change at all. That was all her fault. She thought she understood how the trains ran, and she didn't.
We didn't get any reports like this, Faye.
Actually, I'm sorry, I was missing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just got the, if anybody asked me what they've done, I'd give them the whole wrong, I'd got the whole wrong impression. Gee whiz. Gee whiz. That's the, you see, she looks so mean, doesn't she, now? All of a sudden, she looks mean, mischievous, doesn't she?
Yeah, it looks like a chef again.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's like she's particular. That stay at Nice was a little tame.
Yeah. I didn't like Nice very much. I didn't like the town, and I was in the town all the time in that big pink school. The school was pink, and it had an Art Nouveau statue out in front. It was, Paul Valéry built it.
Do you feel it?
And, yeah. And it had a great big amphitheater where they used to have lectures, and they'd have free lectures all winter long. And everybody, they used to say that everybody who was over 70 would come to the lectures because it was heated. They'd come in off the beach. And then we had one classroom for our school, and then there were some offices, and that was all on the first floor. And then upstairs there were a couple of the big sort of conference rooms, very elaborate, baroque. And that was the whole school. That was all that was there. They used to give law lectures in the amphitheater. And all of our classes were in this other classroom. It's a great, big, long room with benches. And the desk would fold up and fold down so you could have a desk or not. Came off the back of the other.
Well, do you think they treated you like they did the French pupils in school? If you did, you had a little experience, I guess, maybe.
Well,
French going to a French school.
Not really. We studied, what we studied was pretty much what they studied. The grammar, the French grammar that we studied was the grammar that they taught in the lycées.
Yes.
It was exactly the same, so that my knowledge of French grammar now is like what someone who has a baccalaureate in France has. But they didn't really treat us like French students because they were trying to do different things with us. They just, in my division, they were mostly just trying to get us to understand the language, because most people had never even spoken French before.
Yeah.
And they couldn't understand anything. And so a lot of people just sort of came in off the street and signed up for the course, and really had very little concept of French, so that they were dealing with a lot of, everybody had different preparation. There were some of us who studied French academically, and then some people who had just lived in France for a little while and they wanted to learn the grammar. And I wanted to learn how to speak it. And they had a hard job, really,
to
get us all whipped into shape, because we were just so diverse. There was no kind of screening at all. You just went in and signed up.
Yes.
All they wanted was for you to pay your tuition. That's all they cared about.
But
not all, but a large part of it. And grabbing your money.
The way it turned out, you really didn't need to be in school.
No, I don't think so. I learned how to speak. I mean, but I could have learned that outside of school. I didn't learn anything about French grammar that I didn't already know, and they certainly didn't even try to teach us any literature. So I was interested in that. We did some readings a couple of times from plays and short stories and things like that, and she would tell us what the book was that we'd read from, and so I'd go buy the book and read it. But then we wouldn't talk about it in class. We read something from Balzac, and I went and got the book and read it, and I really had a hard time with the words. His vocabulary is just incredible, and
you
I had a hard time with it. So.
You know, Scott's vocabulary is hard, too. Do you know that?
Never read him.
Scott? Sir Walter Scott?
I've never read Sir Walter Scott.
Well, you'd think, well, he's just an old romancer, you see, but he does it with a fancy language. So I guess Balzac.
Balzac, too. He used words that weren't in the dictionary.
Yeah.
And that guy. But she had us do some interesting things, like she'd make us reconstruct sentences. She'd give us words, and or she'd give us a series of words, like boy. But she'd take it. I'm thinking of Balzac still. She took a couple of sentences from this Balzac story, took the sentences verbatim, and then would give us phrases or nouns and adjectives, and we'd have to reconstruct the sentence and see how we'd put together these different parts of the sentence, and that to see the difference in how a French sentence is constructed and how English is constructed. That was interesting. I enjoyed doing that. And then a lot of the times she'd just have us talk. You know, she'd ask us things.
You just like you just like language, don't you?
I do.
Well, the the countryside has the gift for language. They find beautiful language, you see. They don't hold up over a choice of a word. You see the words come to them. They use the ones that come to them. It's really nice. Of course, it's not like what you do. They don't have a critical knowledge. I say that's something. That's nice. Yes. Oh, I know what I told you that about a while ago. I mentioned that you know those pieces, the freshman's little pieces. You know, I could have sent them to you, but you see, there's, believe it or not, there's a certain critical superstructure that goes along with all of this. And won't speak for itself. And you can't do it by mail. It simply won't work. You have to, I think, the ears are the best. And just practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just had to see this go along. That's what it was. I see she didn't pay attention to that over there. She had too much else to do.
She looked back one time and said, "What are you doing to me?"
That's true. What have you done to me?
That was perfectly happy way I was.
That in connection with that little freshman. I forget what I said. What did I say?
You could write rings around you.
Maybe something like that.
Oh, I just sent him a
song. Something like that. Well, I rather suspected it was true.
Oh, shoot. He's taunting you.
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, Faye. I kept thinking Debbie was timid, you see, but she's not timid.
Debbie timid?
Yeah.
She's tough.
Well, I've never seen a tough sign.
She's tough. We're going to toughen her up a little more.
No, she was tough on us.
That time Suzanne heard me, little Margaret came in with a boat song, a Mendelssohn boat song, and she had worked on it so hard, and she'd had just a few lessons, and she came in, and she played it through for me. Suzanne liked it so well. Usually she was working, she was at the house. She was going ahead working, but I was conscious that she was standing in the door of the hall listening. And after it was all over, I realized that she had listened. After I got to dressing Margaret down, and when Margaret finished, I said, "Margaret, you know very well you're doing everything you shouldn't do to that. It isn't Mendelssohn at all, it's you." And I proceeded just to tear the whole thing apart like Margaret's used to doing, having me do. And Margaret took it, you know, as if she knew what I was saying. She said, "Well, I'll see what I can do with it for next lesson." I said, "Well, do it. Don't play it like that for me anymore." And I said, "I don't want to listen to it. I want to hear Mendelssohn." She's 12, you know. So when she left, before the next student came in, Suzanne never comes to me. You know, she never comes around when I'm teaching. And she tiptoed up to me. She said, "You say she's 12?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I don't know how you can do it." She said, "I would have cried and gone home and never come back."
Debbie, what? I still can't see why in the world you went to Corsica.
Because it was wild and untamed. It was for the tough part of me. I just wanted to see it. I like islands. I loved islands when I was in Greece.
I see.
Just like going to islands. I like the idea of getting on a boat and going across water and getting on an island and you can't get off.
But it wasn't wild.
Yes, it was. It was wilderness. When we went from Ajaccio to Piana, there was nothing in between. Just woods and mountains down to the sea.
Just the whole island
is like that. And every once in a while there'd be a little stone house where somebody lived, where a farmer lived. But it's mountainous, and you can't farm, really. It's just straight up and down, rocks, with some trees sort of hanging in between the rocks. But it's lovely. It's beautiful to look at. But you can't get around in it too easily, because there are no roads. You can walk through it. You could hike across it, but there's only one road. We didn't have a car anyway. We walked everywhere.
We walked cross country?
We walked down to the beach every day and back. We went to the beach. Went swimming and kayaking. We went out in a kayak.
You didn't walk cross country?
No, we walked on the road. And hike through the mountains.
Oh, you hiked through the mountains?
We didn't hike through the mountains. We stayed on the road.
On the beach?
No, on the road down to the beach, and then on the beach. The beach was not very big. There weren't too many places where there were real beaches there.
Well, what'd you do? You saw the interior from the bus?
Yes.
Oh, you crossed it in the bus?
Went from Ajaccio to Piana for 4 hours in a little tiny bus. winding around the roads like that. Because the roads are just built right on the edges of the mountains. And so you're half falling off the mountain every time. And the bus was really small. There were only, I think, about 15 passengers and the bus driver and all the mail and supplies and baggage and everything else to go to all the villages between Ajaccio and where he was going to Porto. That was the next town over from Piana. Piana was on a bay, and Porto was at the end of the bay, and Piana was on one side. So he had to, he made one run a day to take people and mail and anything else.
Did Faulkner ever get out of Mississippi?
I don't know. When he got the Nobel Prize.
Oh, I mean when he was young.
I don't know.
You see, they learn without being told. You see that reporting is more satisfying than the experience for the artist. Now I can say that to you, and you see, I bait you with it. I don't mean to, but it's, you have to consider that. I don't know how it works out.
That's because you don't want to be cut off from experience.
But see, I've had more in Lassen County than I had in three continents before. See, my experience is in North Africa. I really didn't see much. And in Kunming and those last trips back part of China and on up to the, you know, the Xi'an Plateau, Central Asian Plateau. You see, there's no answer to all these things, but it's something that opens your mind. I read Moby Dick. I read Melville as experience, and he opens up those try works, you see, in a way I'd never see if I were there. And he has one little section on Nantucket that brings it alive. And being there doesn't necessarily bring it alive. Now, you see, I'm not, I mean, you see.
I see what you're saying.
But, see, that's the sort of thing you don't, there's no deciding, no, you know, you don't put an end to anything like that. I think a statement like that actually brings to life a lot of things that you wouldn't, you see, makes you look at all of it. Look at your bus trip around those little peaks and all. And then, you see, I've seen the Hammer Clan in Lassen County, and that's on the most beautiful land. I never dreamed of anything like that. Oh, it was deep. Just like just way down, and the potato country over at La Crosse, just solid loam, you see. It goes all the way, a strip across, all the way to Hastings, like that. I've never been to Blackton. I've been to La Crosse, I've seen it there. That's 20 miles. There's But it's like the boy, one of the little freshmen, he said, he's nice. K came over. We've been talking. I'd sort of been beating him a little bit. He came over to the office one day and he says he was tired of school. You see, he kind of got it, but he figured me up on that. And he had his plans. And as soon as he could get out of there, he was going on expedition. He was going around the world in a sloop. I thought something peculiar about that. And then it came to me right there. He'd almost, while he was sitting there, in a sloop. I said, what in the hell would you see from a sloop? It's almost like taking a trip blindfolded, you see. He wouldn't even see the whales from over there. He wouldn't meet the Pequod. He wants to travel. He wants experience and see the world. How's he going to do it? With a bunch of roughnecks like himself, and he wasn't interesting. So it's amazing, you see, what contortions you can get into in the search for experience. It's amazing, and sometimes it's right at home.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you don't want to draw any line. So nice. Enjoy the visit. I'm going to get this little letter in the mail, or else I'm going to get sued.
Y'all
don't
need
to get Caroline. Not going to get Caroline. I'll tell you why. I got the remote written and get it off. I'm going to do that another hour.
Devin?
Yeah.
I want you to do something for me.
Pardon?
I want you to do something for me. Tell me again about that talk you all had there. That high class talk you all had there when your mama went to sleep.
We were just talking. Well, we were talking about the decay of the concept of morality today. And so my friend Ted was saying that he just wondered what it was like in the 50s, because they seem to have had a concept of morality in the 50s. Now, he never said what that was. They were going on and on about this. My mother was falling asleep. And he turned to her and he said, how did Joe McCarthy happen in the 50s? And my mother didn't have anything to say. She just said, I'm a. She had to wake up. And then she thought about it a while, and after he was gone, she said, boy, that really threw me.
And you all tell that every now and then?
It just happened.
Yeah.
It just happened last night, or the night before, the Monday night.
Oh, it's recent.
It just happened.
Oh, I thought it was something that happened way long back.
No, it just happened.
Oh, you mean you've been listening to that sort of talk?
All that talk about modern morality and decay and...
And you exposed to a right smart of that kind of talk?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. That's what they talk about a lot.
And you can talk like that?
That's easy.
Well, say something about it. Let me hear what you
Well, you know, my morality is just on the decline. Nobody young people just don't have any morals anymore.
That don't sound like it. What do you do?
It's too hard though when you're laughing about it. He was saying that, okay, how did he put it? That you had to have, the whole country had to have a sense of vision and purpose that it could get behind and follow. And there was no sense of vision and purpose today. That was all gone. And at one time there was vision and purpose in this country. And why is that gone?
Yeah.
What happened to it? But even with all this vision and purpose and a sense of moral right and wrong, how did Joe McCarthy happen?
Oh, yes.
In the 50s, because he was saying that in the 50s, people knew what they were supposed to do, and they knew what was right and what was wrong, and all that.
Shoot. Well, now, you're just repeating what they said. You didn't say that yourself.
No, I didn't, as a matter of fact. I just listened to them. I can throw in things every once in a while. Sort of add.
Keep going.
Keep it going, yeah.
Such as.
Isn't that interesting? No. Such as. Sure is a shame that there's no sense of moral purpose anymore.
Yeah, does that go in?
That does it.
And let them carry the ball?
Mm-hmm. And they just go on and on and on. About Ted thinks he wants to get back to nature, but he doesn't know how to do it, I don't think.
Yeah.
He just wants to go live somewhere where he can have room for his motorcycle.
Oh, he goes over the country in a motorcycle?
Takes pictures. He was down in Micanopy looking for a place to live.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. He's a photographer. He's going to get his master's in photography here.
Oh, is he?
Mm-hmm.
But he's from up the country?
He's from Boston. Well, he's from Kentucky originally. He's from Boston. I knew him in Boston.
He was. But now, you don't talk like that very much.
No. People like that, well, when you talk, I get to thinking when I talk to people like that they're just too clever for me because I can't. Either they get into statistics about issues and I don't know any statistics, or they get into issues that I don't know anything about.
Well, Debbie, how'd you escape it? They all do it, huh? Just escape it. You just escaped it.
I'm ignorant.
Well, I am too. Maybe that's where I escaped it.
I'm just too ignorant. I don't know, you know, I don't talk about things that I don't know anything about.
Because I
can't say anything if I know something about it.
Yeah.
You know, so I just usually don't say too much if I don't know.